Thank you so much, Steve. Hi, everybody. It's Bill and it's Wendy, and this is Wednesday, and we're thrilled that you're listening. We are at 312-981-7200. Hi, Wendy.
Hey, Billy boy. Steve, you sound better. I hope you're feeling better.
Coming along. Thank you very much.
Awesome.
I want to vow I will be doing no pranks today. Because
come on.
No.
You've set a precedent.
You know, what started out is just a fun goof. I don't know if you saw it.
That's you.
I am a fun goof. The attention that got yesterday. I was on Rachel Maddow's show last night talking about it, and people were calling up. Some people with me, some against me. Whatever, that's fine.
There really are two ladders out there today. They're expecting you to come back.
I wonder if that's not a trap, Wendy. Because yesterday, part of this was we needed to find a ladder to get me up that high, and this time it's like a big piece of cheese on a big.
It's the honeypot.
Yeah, I think they're trying to trap me over there.
Sabotage.
I'm afraid. I have to tell you what I saw this morning, and boy, this is good marketing. Every once in a while, you have to applaud. When you see good marketing, you say to yourself, those guys nailed it. I was at the train station today at Ogilvie Station, and this is Colon Cancer Awareness Month. Did you know that? So they have, at Ogilvie Station, to commemorate Colon Cancer Awareness Month, they have set up a giant inflatable colon that you can walk through.
Like a bouncy house?
Yes.
Yes. Really?
It's a tunnel that replicates.
That's what your colon is, the human tunnel.
It's a human tunnel.
It was actually Governor Ogilvie's nickname as well.
Oh, come on now.
He was known as the colon.
All right. So
was Colin Powell there?
Colin Powell was not there. Now, you would think, like, somebody thought that up, and you say, yeah, well, who's at Ogilvie Station early in the morning on a Wednesday is a bunch of business people and stuff. They're not going to want to walk through a big inflatable colon.
Was it crowded?
Jammed to the rafters. You couldn't get in.
That is a packed colon.
That's a big full colon.
Take something for that.
So did they have a little area where you could lay your briefcase down while you jumped through it? I would go through it.
You can't physically jump through it. It's shaped. It's like a it's like your colon. I mean, you know what your colon looks like, right?
Is it fiberglass though, like the heart at the Museum of Science and Industry that you walk through?
It's inflatable.
Oh,
which your colon is not, by the way.
Mine is.
Oh, yours is
special. It was a birthday gift years ago.
But I see it from afar. I see it like way down, I get off the train and I look over and I'm like, that looks like a giant colon. What's that all about? And I didn't have my giant Steve Cochran head to usually I carry that and I put it on stuff. That's my fun game. So
would that be great to put it on a colon?
I definitely should. So I see it and I go, oh, all right, I get it. It's a colon, but no one's going to want to. Who wants to go through that? Loads of people. Lots
you
and lots of people.
You didn't walk through it?
The lines were too long.
Oh, my God.
I couldn't get near it. There was a semicolon nearby that didn't have along a line. I could have gone through that one.
And it would
much
take
quicker.
You less time.
Yeah, yeah, half the time. But good for you, colon marketing people, for getting the word out.
Did you have to walk through with a hat made of fiber or something so it would clear it out?
No. They should have that option.
Fiber One bars right next door.
Right. They should open a booth.
That would have been a perfect tie-in.
Next time. Next year. It's always something awareness month, and you say to yourself, well, that's probably a good idea, because even though we know there's colon problems, sometimes you need a little nudge.
So were you nudged? Did you make your appointment for your colonoscopy you said you were going to have a year ago?
You know, my wife has been after me because she heard that segment that we did. Was that 2 weeks ago?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you were supposed to have it last year in November on your birthday?
By the end of the year, I will go in.
That's what you said last year.
Yeah. I did say that last year. By the end of this year, 2017, I guarantee you I'm going in for colonoscopy. It's going to take me a while to get, despite everybody going, it's not as bad as you think. It's going to take me a little while to gear up for it.
I got a guy. I can hook you up.
Do you have a guy?
Yeah, I do.
He does it in a white van. on Lower Wacker.
I'm all right with that. Now, my wife has, she's gone through the procedure, and I know you have as well. And her doctor is a woman, and I would never say this about almost anything else, but in this particular instance, I would like a man to perform this procedure.
That's what my husband said, too. And you guys are weird. Quite honestly, I think a woman would have a much more gentle touch.
She'd be more delicate. You're right. I agree with that, but I also think that there's more opportunities for giggling.
Bill, they do this for a living. They don't go in here and look at this guy.
What if she does not enjoy the show? What if this it's particular not a show. Doctor... No, the show that you and I are on.
Oh, oh.
This show.
I thought you meant the
show.
Colonoscopy.
No.
Are you ready for the show, Doc?
No, I know that that isn't a show. I understand that. But what if she is not a fan of the work that you and I do?
What if you get a guy who's not a fan of the show?
Oh, that's true, too.
He's stronger.
That's very true. I hadn't thought of that.
It's funny, the whole guy-girl thing. I have to be honest with you, being a woman, for the most part of my growing up, I've had a man doctor because there weren't a lot of female doctors when I was in need of...
Have you had a male gynecologist ever?
Oh, yeah.
Have you? And that doesn't faze you at all?
Yeah, and he wasn't very funny. He would try and crack jokes, and it was like, you know...
Do you want a funny gynecologist?
No!
You don't want a funny
guy. But then you don't want someone real serious either. But this was like, you know, a teenager saying, I'm a little late with my period. And he goes, okay, we'll hop up on the table. Let's see how pregnant you are.
Oh.
That's not funny.
No, it's not.
I wasn't, but still. That's just
not funny.
Funny
at all.
Somebody needed to write his material.
That's crazy.
I switched doctors after that.
Yeah. You did the right thing there.
Yeah, I didn't like that. And now I don't care if it's a male or a female.
For most things, I'm exactly in that same ballpark. And you know me, I'm so for equal rights, and there's no reason why a woman shouldn't be doing this. But I would be more comfortable with this particular procedure if it was a guy.
I know what it is. It's like you could go to a female doctor if it didn't involve your private parts.
That's, yeah.
Like a dermatologist or... Yeah.
And they never draw funny faces on your private parts, right? That's fake. They would never do that, would they?
What doctors have you gone to? Did you go to my gynecologist?
Yeah, the funny gynecologist.
That's a great play.
Yeah. Yeah. Ibsen. Henrik Ibsen wrote that.
All right. Harold wants to jump in before we take a break. Harold, Bill has been putting off his colonoscopy. Go ahead.
For 3 years.
Yeah. Well, it doesn't make sense there, Bill. You know, you're going to wait till the end of the year, and if you do have something, and it's advanced, it's like, well, you'll that's
it's going to ruin your holidays.
Can
it's
I tell
you? Well, forget about holidays. I mean, it's going to ruin your life. I mean,
no, I
you
know.
You
go tomorrow.
Don't go tomorrow because you got to set up an appointment. But you know, you should set up an appointment for a week or two or whenever they're available. And
no walk-ins,
you,
Wendy.
Yeah, no walk-ins.
No walk-ins.
Yeah. It's a quick procedure. It doesn't take that long. It's a little bit of prep, but you know they got to do. But I got to tell you, you're gonna have a female there no matter what. It's not like the doctor's like we're closing down the office and everybody go home.
There's always women in there no matter what.
There's gonna be an
assistant.
It might be female, but it's probably you can't pick that. So
you can't do an all men review show.
Right. I mean, they're in and out real quick. Well, pardon the pun.
Yeah, I get it.
You're not the first guy to do that.
No, I know. I know.
Right. Your colon is not that spectacular, I got to tell you.
You don't know that, Wendy.
Well, I don't know that.
I've gotten a lot of compliments.
Do it for your wife. Do it for your wife that if they do find something, it's early stage or whatever, if they don't find nothing, then you're happy for the next 5 years.
No, that's true.
And Harold, don't you admit that the breakfast after a colonoscopy is the best breakfast you've ever had?
I really didn't think about that too much.
Oh, my God, because you have to fast the day before, and then you're groggy, and then as soon as you're finished, you feel okay.
Oh,
you're hungry.
It's not as bad as you are making it out to be, and you have never done it.
No, that's true.
As people who've done it, it's just like, it's, you know, I mean, I don't know. It's just like going to get your car, you know.
A lube job.
Yeah.
It is kind of a lube job. That's where I'll go, is Speedy Lube. They'll get me in and out in 15 minutes.
They'll put you up on the rack. It'll be great.
Right. That's comfortable.
You know
enough.
That noise? Yeah. Thank you. All right, Harold, thank you for saying it. He's not going to change his mind.
I'm going to go by the end of the year. See, in my head, if I go at holiday time, I have so many other things to look forward to that it'll get like just mixed in with all the other holiday stuff.
Yeah, put a bow on it.
You should go by the end of this month, which is April. So you should, have it.
Oh, yeah. Man. All right.
I mean, it's you're just all embarrassed because you're in a vulnerable position and all this. But this is like a guy who's like a carpenter who's building a wall. It's like, this is not the first wall I've ever built.
Right.
It's not the first colonoscopy. They don't sit there and go, oh my God, Bill Left was here. It's like they don't care.
I'll be in selfies, weird selfies.
Oh, now that would be fun. They did it with Joan Rivers when she was having one.
I know they did.
Harold, we got to run.
They did it with the quarterback.
With Jay Cutler. Very funny, Harold. Thank you very much.
Take care.
You know, do you know
can you hold your thought?
Yeah, I will hold my
don't
thought.
Don't forget that, though, please. All right. It's Bill Leff. It's Wendy Snyder, 720 WGN. So March is Colon Cancer Awareness Month.
It is, yes.
Be aware of your colon. You should have come out with This Is the End by The Doors, by the way.
I was trying to think of something clever, but not graphic.
Next time.
All right. Bill is hemming and hawing. I hate that expression.
Well,
but
I'm not doing it simultaneously. I hemmed for a while, and now I'm hawing. Over at Ogilvie Transportation Center, because of colon Cancer Awareness Month, they have a giant inflatable colon that you could walk through. Who's doing it? Little kids, you say? No. Grown-ups, adults, business people. We're walking through it, going through it.
Whee!
Just touching parts of it and stuff. It was inflatable. So it got us onto our discussion, which is I have still not had the colonoscopy yet. And by year's end, I will. But now people are saying you should have it done sooner.
Well, you said this last year, by year's end last
year.
I know you did.
Yeah, I know.
So we know you are a liar.
This year, I'm doing it.
Yeah, that's what you said last year.
This year, I mean it.
Larry, you have an idea and a great one as to why he should do it sooner rather than later. Go ahead.
Oh, absolutely. It would be an absolute perfect topic for your next live remote somewhere. Wendy, you could give us, well, I was going to say blow by blow, but that's probably the wrong term. All the points. Maybe Bill would have his wife there, his really wonderful daughters, to tell us just how badly he's freaking out. I mean, being brave.
Right.
And you could bring the giant Steve Cochran head, and we could cover your butt up with that, so I wouldn't see anything.
Perfect.
Hometown voices. How proud would they be? Yeah. All right.
And it echoes.
I think that's a great idea, Larry. Thank you for that. That's genius.
All right, I don't want to be there. I will take you out to
that?
Breakfast.
There wouldn't be a spot. We would have a complete sponsor-free show if we did that.
No, somebody would sponsor
somebody
it.
Be in on that? Yeah.
Fiber One Bar, I'm telling you. Hi, Greg.
You guys, how are you?
Great.
What's going on?
You are just getting right to the butt of the conversation.
Yes.
Incredible.
Yes. Yeah, thank you.
You know, as far as you appearing somewhere, you could just be on, have your backside on the other side of a privacy curtain and the entire world on the other side. Who knows what's going on in the back there?
Oh, Facebook Live it?
Yeah, sure.
Assbook.
Well, absolutely.
They don't make that, do they?
They will.
They will start.
You'll be the poster boy for it. All right, you had a comment?
Well, I was going to say something about as far as how hard it is. I'm having my second one, getting ready for my second one, and the worst part of it really, truly is the fact that it means it's been 10 years since the last one.
Yeah.
That's really the worst part.
I know, that it goes by
so quickly.
Do it
in March. That makes it an anniversary on a date that means something because it's Awareness Month.
Do it this month.
Well, this month is, you know, we only have a couple days left.
You can schedule it.
You know.
Get at it. Mm. Get at it. They've got pressure washers.
Let me check my schedule. I don't need that.
God, we're all 12 years old once again, honestly.
Well, it's almost it's as good as a fart joke.
Oh, man.
Never goes out of style.
And that you may do during the procedure. So here's another thing to make you be embarrassed.
Need that aggravation.
As far as having a woman there, too,
yeah.
the very first one that I had, there was a woman there. Unfortunately, she was the mother of one of the kids that my kid played hockey with.
Oh, that's embarrassing.
Not only did I know who it was, I had to see her on a weekly basis.
Did she work at the hospital, or did she just wander in?
Oh, didn't recognize you from that direction.
Well, you got to walk in. You don't back in.
No, that's true. All right, Greg.
Well, good luck.
Hello, here's my butt.
Thank you.
Good luck, Greg, on your next.
I hope somebody tuned in just to hear that part of the show.
Colonoscopy. All right, you have to do it.
I'm doing it. I am doing it. But toward the end of the year.
You're a baby. We have to take a break. We
end
have
of
to
me,
do
some end of the year. It all ties in, Wendy.
That's our radio promotion. And I like the whole idea of the curtain
the
there.
End of the year special?
Because you'll be all loopy, and we'll just see, you know, we could just do the show from the front part.
Right.
And then business in the back, just like a human mullet.
Human mullet. All right, let's take a break. We need a break. Some news and then more show. It's us. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN. It's Bill Leff. It's It's Wendy Snyder.
Hit the on button.
And yeah, if when you guys get your own radio show, the best way to be heard is to hit the button that says on, and then all of everybody listening gets to hear your voice. We're at 312-981-7200. Wendy, this morning, is calling for the firing of one of Trump's Topley people. Maybe I shouldn't have turned it on. Hold on, I'm going to turn it off.
Turn it off and start again.
It's off.
All right. I would like Sean Spicer to be fired.
Oh, Wendy.
I got to tell
Sean
you.
Sean Spicer.
I have heard the audio. I have reheard the audio. And in case you haven't heard the audio, I believe, Bill, you got the audio
Brought
ready.
Yeah.
He is so unprofessional. He it's all too personal to him.
Sure.
And he should be removed.
Well, he's in an extremely difficult position because now every day, and he even mentioned this week he's doing a presser he's got one scheduled Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. He's got a very busy schedule, but his daily grind is deflecting back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, everything that the president has said. He's under a lot of scrutiny.
I get it.
And it's getting to him.
Well, it's his job to defend the president,
yes.
But it's not his job, in my opinion, to be so defensive.
Well, yesterday, as you know, he was very rude to April Ryan. April Ryan is with the American Urban Radio Network out of Washington. She's in the Washington Bureau. The name may not be that familiar to you, but I will remind you that it is not her first time being a big part of a news story. It happened earlier when Donald Trump suggested to Ms. Ryan, because she is African-American, that she may know and be able to set up a meeting with him and other prominent African-American people because she's black, which didn't sit well with everybody, and it probably shouldn't have. So yesterday, during Sean Spicer's daily press conference, like I said, he's got one scheduled every day this week, there was a very interesting exchange between Mr. Spicer and Ms. Ryan that didn't go real well. Would you agree with that?
Yes.
Yeah. Let's play some snippets. Kevin, keep your eye on it because we'll probably stop you at some point. But listen to the way this situation was handled. How could this have been handled better? Let's listen.
Sean, don't seem so happy.
Kev, stop for just a second. I have to say this. That seemed a little bit out of place because it's true he had a scowl on his face. He did.
She was not being professional right there.
It was strange to start the conversation out with, you don't seem to be very happy. He didn't seem to be very happy, but you probably could have just asked the question without throwing in, you know, that part of it, right?
I have mixed emotions on this, and Steve Bertrand might be able to jump in. A lot of these press conferences are not so stiff as they used to be.
Right, true.
There is more repartee between the press secretary and the press.
Yeah.
However, I agree with you. That seemed like a bad way to start.
It did.
Well, they talk every day. I mean, they're, you know,
sure
together, but sometimes reporters
get too comfortable. That's what that sounded like to me.
Or think that they're part of the question rather than the question.
All right, so that's how it started. Right or wrong, it started out with her saying, you don't seem very happy. And he didn't seem very happy, but it didn't need to be mentioned. All right, so here's the rest.
With all of these investigations, questions of what is, how does this administration try to revamp its image? 2.5 months in, you've got this Yates story today. You've got other things going on. You've got Russia. You've got wiretapping. You've got...
No, we don't have that.
On Capitol Hill.
No, I get it, but you keep... I've said it from the day that I got here until whatever, that there is no connection. You've got Russia. If the president puts Russian salad dressing on his salad tonight, somehow that's a Russian connection. But every single person...
All right, let's stop for just a second there. Your thoughts on that part of it?
All right, first of all, Russia is a very serious issue.
Without a doubt.
And he shouldn't be making light of it. And you know that he wrote that joke and has just been waiting to deliver it.
The Russian salad dressing joke? Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
And it was snippy. It was not professional. And it really bothered me. And I would like to see him fired.
So he's saying there, Russia is not our problem. Russia is your problem because you keep bringing it up, but it's not. There's nothing there.
It is their problem. It's all of our
problem.
And he's making so much light of it by mentioning the Russian salad dressing. And you know what? Quite honestly, he could have constructed the joke a little better. I would have just said, if the president has Russian dressing on his salad, I wouldn't say Russian salad dressing on his salad. Yeah. You don't need to repeat that.
Well, he's no Gallagher. That's John Spicer. He's not perfect with the jokes.
And yes, he could have been Gallagher. He could have had a big bottle of Russian dressing out there.
A mallet.
Yeah.
Just crushed it.
I like Russian dressing, by the way.
As a side note,
it's like a Catalina.
Hey,
I just want to say it's kind of like Arby's sauce.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. All right. So Steve, for just a second, let's take a look at that part of it, because that's a very important part of it. As he deflects and says, Russia's not our problem. Russia is your problem. You keep bringing it up. How could you, if you're in Sean Spicer's position, how could you not acknowledge the fact that Russia is a major, major situation going on right now and certainly worthy of a question from the press?
Well, you know, his point is that, look, we're answering the questions when they come up, and nothing has changed here. We said that we weren't involved. You guys are people stressing on it. You know, it's your problem. I'm going to go have my salad.
Flynn wasn't involved. Manafort wasn't involved. We don't know this yet.
Who they with a straight face said wasn't really a major part of the administration.
Not in the last month.
He was a delegate counter.
Right.
That's an issue there.
Right.
The guy who ran their campaign, he tried to repaint him
as not having that big of a hand in it all.
Right.
And that is totally untrue. Can Tom jump into this as well? Hi, Tom. How are you?
How you doing? Yes. You know, the first thing I don't like when the media says is they use little words to paint a false narrative. They say there may be Russia collusion with the Trump campaign, possible Russian collusion. I could say I may get hit with a tornado or lightning tomorrow. I might possibly get hit by lightning tomorrow. There's no evidence of collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia. There's no evidence. There is more evidence right now of surveillance by the Obama administration of the Trump transition team. There's more evidence of surveillance and illegally unmasking than of any evidence of.
What does that mean? What do you mean illegally unmasking? Can you explain that for me? I don't know what you mean.
Unmasking means if some intelligence agency is surveilling, say, the Russian ambassador, which CNN likes to refer to as a spy. The Russian ambassador is being surveillance, and that Russian ambassador starts talking to a Trump transition team, which he should be doing during the transition because they want to set up a procedure how they're going to relate with Russia with the new administration. And they now pick up that phone call of Flynn talking to the ambassador. Unmasking would be releasing Flynn's name, number one, and releasing what Flynn said, number two.
Have they done that?
Do that? Because there was no court order to surveillance Flynn.
Have they done that?
Yes, they have unmasked people. Follow the news. Unmasking has occurred. This is where the investigation. We need an investigation on this. What did President Obama know, and when did he know it as far as the Trump transition team being surveillance? This is major, major, major. Way more major than the Trump collusion. There's no Trump collusion. There's no evidence.
Tom, why are you so upset about this? The president's a big boy. He can handle his own issues. You seem so bothered by this.
Yes, because I'm bothered by the fact that you could say you can make news about anything by putting the words may and possible in front of it. You could say, Tom, you may get hit by lightning tomorrow. And you say it 10 times. My friends are going to come up to me and say, Tom, I heard you got hit by lightning. Because they're going to drop the word may out of what they hear in their eardrums.
You may need to up your blood pressure medication. That's what I'm telling you now for your own good, Tom.
I'll see you guys later.
Thanks. No, you're just so upset.
I'm not upset. I'm not upset. I listen to the media, and I know I'm on the Trump supporter, and the media's got us outnumbered. The only guy we got is one little Sean Hannity. You guys got 20 Sean Hannitys on the other side, trying to pretend they're reporters, and they're not reporters. They're just like Sean Hannity pushing an agenda, but they try to pretend they're like Don Lemon, Anderson Cooper. They all try to pretend, oh, they're not like Sean Hannity. They're not opinion shows. They're all opinion shows. You turn on any CNN, MSNBC, they're all opinion shows. The same thing with you guys. You're reflecting your opinions in this. Everybody's got an opinion when it comes to politics.
Sean, Tom. The reason this started is I just think it's ironic that the president's press secretary can say We don't have a situation with Russia. You're creating a situation, but there is a situation with Russia. You have to acknowledge the right.
You explain me what's the situation with Russia. Explain it to me.
That there may have been tampering. There may have been collusion between the United States.
You're doing the same thing now. You're just saying there may have been tampering.
But you have to look into it.
Are you saying then? Are you disagreeing with the fact that Russia tried to make an impact on this election? Are you disputing that as well?
I'm disputing the fact that there was any talking between the Trump campaign.
Okay, so you are. So
Kellyanne Conway was not calling up Russia and saying, okay, next week I want you to release this thing on WikiLeaks if you got something. And then Sean Spicer or someone else was saying, oh, release this on this day. And they were talking back and forth. None of that exists. There's no evidence of that.
So they shouldn't the investigating of this should stop immediately. There's nothing there. There's no reason to investigate it.
Go ahead and investigate it. But what I'm saying is, the bottom line is, anybody can throw out an allegation, then you can say you got to have an investigation. So I'm saying let's have an investigation of the Obama administration.
Is that what
the Watergate scandal? Let's have a big investigation of that. Let's talk about it every day. I want to know about the surveillance. I want to know about Trump being maybe vindicated that quote unquote he was wiretapped, which when he said that. He wasn't saying Barack Obama went in and physically wiretapped the Trump phone. Barack Obama himself.
He did technically say that at the beginning, but yeah, I know.
Right. And you really believe when Trump said that he was saying that?
Yes.
Because then he called him sick. But then he called him sick. It wasn't like he meant the Obama administration. He said Barack Obama wiretapped me. He's sick.
A second. I'm aghast right now. Are you telling me you really think Trump meant that Barack Obama himself physically performed the wiretap?
No, but I think he what he said was that Barack Obama directed it, and then he said, had my phones tapped, which is a very, you know, direct sort of thing. They tried to diffuse it by saying,
well, you know, I think most Trump supporters, when they heard him say wiretap and phone tap, they sort of meant, hey, he's being spied on, he's being surveilled.
Because you like him, Tom. You're not taking him for his word. What he said was Barack Obama did it. It's kind of like...
No. When he says Barack Obama did it, he's talking about the administration. If you're taking him for his word and saying Barack Obama physically did it, then you're out in left field.
No, but does his word mean to you? But does it mean to you? Let me just... I want to understand then. So, but when he says Barack Obama did it, do you understand that he means that Barack Obama directed it to be done?
Yes. Under his administration, Barack Obama, during the Barack Obama administration, it happened.
But the president himself, Barack Obama, ordered it to be done.
Well, no, that's why we got to ask the two famous Watergate questions. What did Obama know, and when did he know it regarding this? That's the two famous Watergate questions we got to ask about the surveillance problem that's going on right now of the Trump transition team and the unmasking. We got to ask the Watergate questions about Obama. What did Obama know, and when did he know it? We got to ask.
What do you expect those answers to be?
I think he might have known and looked the other way.
Tom, we have to run. Honestly, we have to take a break. We appreciate you calling. I didn't mean to be disrespectful to you, but it really bothers me that you're all upset about this.
I'm not that upset. I just get a little emotional when I'm on the phone. Nowhere I can relax and have to smoke a cigar with Bill right now.
Yeah, come on down.
I'm off. Okay.
All right. Well, Tom,
Cipirillo with your name on it.
Thanks for calling.
Take care.
I hate that people they go from 0 to 1,000. I've seen it with family members that have different views, and I can't stand it anymore. Can we have a conversation? Once it gets amped up, then the other person gets amped up, and then we have an explosion.
Right. We'll take a quick break because it's needed. We'll come back.
The sighs are back.
We're at 312-981-7200. You can call us there or you can text us there. It's Bill and Wendy, WGN.
It's Bill and Wendy. Sean Spicer loses his cool, tells the reporter to stop shaking his head. I don't know if
her
we
head.
Got to that. Yes.
April her. Ryan.
I don't know if we got to that part of the audio, but it's just a lot of snippiness. And we have another caller. Pat, you don't have a lot of time, but you have the microphone right now.
Yeah, I think the other young man, Tom, was a little emotional about it. But I am a Trump supporter, and here's what I think. I think that in a democracy, you have a free press, and it's very important. And the bickering that's going on is normal, okay? It's actually healthy. However, I do believe that there's diversionary tactics by some people in places that are pushing certain questions and agendas to try to stop the president from accomplishing things that he wants to accomplish. They keep pushing this 100-day agenda and all this other stuff. What happens is when you start arguing with somebody, they can't get done what they need to get done. And I think that's a problem. And I think that that is what's going on, okay? But I think the press has every right to continue to ask these questions. Also, my final statement is all of the different people in the different administrations for the last 20 years, all of the people that are involved with NAS security, Secretary of State, they meet with all of the different ambassadors. They meet with everybody, Russia, Cuba, you name it. They meet, well, not necessarily Cuba, I'm sorry. But they meet with everybody, and it's just a matter of record. That's what they need to do. That's what it's all about. That's what helps keep us secure and safe, as well as prevents somebody from pushing those buttons. So, but I appreciate the time that you've given me, and I think you guys are great.
Oh, Pat, you're very kind. You're very kind. Thanks. I don't remember, Steve, it was Josh Earnest who was Obama's press secretary, right? I don't remember this sort of exchange going on with any frequency when Josh Earnest was doing these press conferences. I agree with everything that was just said, but I just think the climate is so different.
Unprofessional. Sean Spicer's acting very unprofessional in my
opinion.
You say? He needs to be fired. Ouch. He's not happy. He doesn't want this job. Come on. I know we've talked about this before with various people, including Kristen McQueary of the Chicago Tribune. Yeah. It's like, why would anybody want this job? It's a good gig. It looks good on a resume. But it's not. It's going to take him down. It already is starting. How can you not, you know, if somebody says something bad about you, yeah. I'm your partner, I'm going to get emotional and defend you. Yeah. That's what's happening. And that job can't, you got to leave the emotion at home.
And that's a daily grind for him. That's part. He knows every day as he goes to that podium, there's going to be that, right?
Yeah, so he walks in all defensive and ready to snip at people. Don't shake your head.
Yeah, he told April Ryan to stop shaking her head at him. All right, we must take a break. We have news next, and then a lot more show. It's Bill and Wendy, WGN.
Are they going to make a sequel, white wine?
Yeah, they would have to do that. Equal time,
was
right?
Was it the rosé wine?
Dane Neal is here. You know Dane as the host of his own show on Saturday, which I told you, Dane, I got to hear a little bit of on Saturday. Did a bang-up job. Really very nice.
That's what we intend to do. It's right there in the mission statement.
Yep.
Bang-up job
every Saturday. It's Dane Neal. And Dane has brought in a very special guest today.
Well, we talk and have for many years. We talk food, the food space, wine, spirits, beverages, all those kind of intake opportunities that you may have in the Chicagoland area. And when you think about wine, you think about, well, you think initially, a lot of people do, you think France, you think Napa, you think Sonoma. But some of the best wine, the most highly acclaimed wine, and some of the most exciting wine experiences are happening right here in the Chicagoland area and everywhere else. But found here in studio, we've got Tim McHenry. He's the founder and CEO of Cooper's Hawk. Now, we've all heard of Cooper's Hawk.
Sure.
Now we're going to learn exactly what it is and then what you don't know that it is.
Hi, Tim.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Absolutely.
Nice to see you.
You have brought some wine with you. Cooper's Hawk has some great food, but also known for its wine.
Yeah, we don't go anywhere without bringing wine. It's very important.
I like you.
Do all the restaurants, all of your restaurants have, because the ones that I have been in, have like a wine tasting section or room. Is that a standard in all the restaurants?
Correct, yeah. Every restaurant is unique in kind of a design way, but they all have a fundamental tasting room for that experience, and then even a full service bar or restaurant, a lot of fun.
You know, I'm a beer drinker who's just kind of getting into wine, so I don't know where to begin. I think I like red wine, but you just gave me some white wine that's pretty delicious.
Thank you. Yeah,
can you like both?
Yeah, and that's the goal. I mean, like, especially once you get to my stage in your wine career, all wine is awesome. But you definitely kind of learn some favorites. But, you know, growing up in the United States is very different than growing up in Europe, right? We're brought up on orange juice and Coca-Cola,
sure.
Where in Europe they're not exposed to that. So it's very normal for us to be more beer drinkers and definitely start off as more sweet wine drinkers.
And the thought process, too, and that's one of the things that Tim has built into the restaurants and that wine experience, is that and we've talked about it a lot of times, that wine can be an intimidating, kind of unapproachable experience mm-hmm. where you almost don't enjoy or get into wine because you think, hey, I don't know enough. I'll embarrass myself.
That's
I won't be
absolutely
able to do those
true.
And Tim just said all wine is awesome. And when you start with that, I think as the lead in line. And so a lot of the things that they're doing are trying to take those people like yourself, Wendy, that are interested in and can be excited about wine, but maybe need a little bit of kind of help kind of getting into it. Yeah.
A little schooling, if you will.
That's right. And you know, we talk about all wine being awesome. And, you know, nowadays, I think we're all kind of familiar with, okay, if you're going to have chicken or fish, you should have white wine.
Right.
If you're going to have meat, you should have red wine. And now the philosophy, and kind of has always been my philosophy, is you drink what you want with what you want at any given time, right? So there is no more, you know, all the rules.
Yeah.
Yes, there are some fundamental rules that certain wines do taste better and kind of improve the quality of food or the perception of quality. But really, it's everybody's unique, right? So
in those early days where that was the belief, if you're having fish, it's white wine. If you're having meat, it's red wine. What was it about those two particular wines that lent themselves better to either fish or regular meat?
Well, a lot of it is so there's a couple core fundamentals of wine, right? So you've got acidity,
yeah.
you've got tannins, you've got fruit, you've got body being, you know, very kind of alcohol and weight.
Mm-hmm.
So when we talk about lighter dishes like fish, and especially depending on the sauce, you know, the crisp acidity can make the sauce taste better and more exciting. So it kind of wakes up your palate. Now, when you have a great steak, for example, or like a pot roast, you can't even taste the characteristics of a lighter white wine because the food is so powerful. The wine, it's like drinking water
yeah.
almost. So kind of getting that weight and that body. And then probably the most important thing, and the biggest misconception in the wine world is drinking red wine with chocolate. It's like, it's not good. It's just, you know, people think like, oh, wow, this is so good together. No, it's not. So
white's
you have
the
to
way
have,
to go with chocolate?
Sweet is the way to go
ah.
with chocolate. So the most important concept of pairing dessert wines with desserts is
yeah.
comparing having an equal level of sweetness, right? So you can have a less sweet, maybe like a port with chocolate.
Yeah.
But you definitely want to have something I brought today, like an ice wine with cheesecake. You got to have that sweetness level. Otherwise, it's just all out of balance.
A sommelier once told me, I'm anxious to hear if you agree or disagree with this, that if done properly, the wine will make the food taste better and the food will make the wine taste better. Does that seem to be true for you?
That's 100% true.
Yeah.
And that's the art of it. And so, you know, in the wine world, and I think you'd agree, Dane, you know, you can debate this stuff. There's very few laws, but if you do get that perfect pairing, it is incredible in
mm-hmm.
so many ways. So it's a lot of fun.
Let's talk about the ice wine for just a little bit. I think when people hear about it for the first time, you just assume it's like a frozen wine, like a Slurpee that's
yeah.
made of wine.
But wow, that's a great idea.
We should invent that.
I would love that.
That.
That would be so good. But it means that the grapes are always frozen throughout the process, right? Is that how the ice wine
Listen
works?
Listen to you. Is
yeah, that's
right?
pretty good. No, you're not. But that's
I'm
pretty
wrong?
Good.
Am
yeah.
I wrong? Oh, what does it mean then?
Well, it does mean. So what we do is they're left on the vine until they're almost like raisins. So after all the grapes have been picked, the Cabernet grapes, the Chardonnay grapes, these grapes... and for us, it's Vidal Blanc out of Michigan and sometimes Canada.
Yeah.
They're left on the vine until they're so shriveled up they look like raisins. They are raisins. And there's only a drop of juice left. And we wait until the first freeze to the grapes turn into rocks, and we pick the grapes at night. So, yes, they are frozen, but they're
yeah.
only frozen for a moment in time. And then it's the thaw process that allows the grapes to start releasing the juice as they break down, and we press the juice out. And the juice is like a syrupy maple syrup. It's like super sweet and delicious. We ferment half of the sugar and leave the other half in. So you have a lightly alcoholic wine that has a very rich sweetness and characteristic.
But a much more difficult process, it sounds like,
oh,
right?
Oh, it's super, yeah. It's yeah. a nightmare for the you know, the pickers, you know, because you're working
sure.
at night, it's freezing, and... yeah, and there's 100 ways to screw it up, so you have to be very careful. So,
and we know the restaurant business in and of itself is one of the toughest businesses out there. So have one and then have kind of a, you know, a concept where you're leaning more towards the demographic of the wine side, even though the tent is big and the arms are outstretched trying to embrace new people. But 26 locations for Cooper's Hawk right now in 8 states, and it looks like 30 by the end of the year.
Correct, yeah.
I mean,
wow.
That's pretty impressive.
Congrats.
That's great.
No, thank you. Thank goodness we didn't know any better back in the day.
Yeah, when was the first one?
October 5th, 2005 in Orland Park.
Yeah,
so,
that's
super
the
cool.
flagship store.
That's right. And still today, our most successful restaurant.
Oh,
of 26,
excellent.
So
that's great.
It's a great story.
All right, a quick break and then more discussion. If you want to jump in, we're at 312-981-7200. Stay here. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN.
I made wine from the lilac tree. Put my heart in its recipe.
What is this, Kevin?
Makes me see what I want to see.
Jeff Buckley. Lilac wine. Do they make lilac wine at Cooper's Hawk?
We do not.
Are you planning on it someday?
And we are not planning
it. maybe for the Lombard 300th anniversary or something.
The Lilac Festival.
Dane Neal is here. He is the star of his own self, Dane Neal. And then Tim McHenry is also here from Cooper's Hawk Restaurants. How many locations now and how many will be here by next year?
26 locations, and we'll have 30 by the end of the year.
Incredible. So. Good for you.
We've been talking a lot of wine, but you mentioned in there restaurants, right? Yeah. And so there's got to be some food in there as well, and more than just maybe the cheese that you have at some kind of wine stops. And so even though wine has been the central kind of thought process, the food has been front and center as well. Excited about some of the things that you guys are doing on the food side, the collaborations with some of these chefs. So if people want to have wine and eat, they can do that there too.
Yeah, we really focus on, obviously, a great quality wine program with something for everyone. And the same thing on the food side. We've got 74 items on the menu, some kind of new, more modern twist, some classics, and then kind of the broad base of our kind of Cooper's Hawk specialties that we're really proud of.
You know what's overwhelming is when you go to a place, you see something on the menu that you have a taste for, and then you ask your server, what wine would be paired with that? And they say, what do you like? That's a tough question to answer. Typically, I'll say a red wine, I full-bodied. I don't really know what any of that stuff means.
Yeah, it can be intimidating. So one of the great things we do at Cooper's Hawk is on the menu, we have a bin number next to each item. So it gives you kind of it's really a collaboration between myself, our head chef of the company, Matt McMillan, and our winemaker, Rob. So, you know, we have this tough job of sitting in a room, tasting all the wines, tasting all the food, and debating the pairing.
That's
so
awful.
It's terrible.
To do that.
I know, right?
Grueling.
So we try to really kind of break it down and make it simple so that you can come in and not be intimidated, you know, so
yeah.
It's fun.
Yeah, I don't know why people, okay, so you start a restaurant and then you think you need, 29 more, mm-hmm. right? And then you think, well, geez, I've got lots of time on my hand and I want to go ahead and start a wine club. And when you think about it, like wine is one of those things that, and you've heard those conversations where people, once they get into it, they're really into it.
Sure.
And they want to do as much of it and learn as much about it and experience as much as they can. And I was absolutely, there's clubs out there where you can get different selections and different wines sent to your home, but they have done this as well. So as they kind of introduce people to it with the wine program at the restaurants, then you've got the wine club, and is it 250,000 members?
That's correct, yeah.
Of the wine
club.
That's
impressive.
Yeah. Founded in the wine capital of the world, Orland Park, Illinois.
I mean, isn't that
screw you, Sonoma.
I mean, under the radar in a lot of different ways, but that's got to be the biggest, like, wine club, like, going, or at least one of them, right?
Yeah, I'm sure, yeah, the largest wine club in the U.S. And, and outside of the U.S., wine clubs aren't really a big thing. In Europe, yeah. They just go down the street and hook up their jug.
7-Eleven's got, like,
a... Right, sure. So if you're a member of the wine club, you obviously get a vinyl jacket.
Correct.
Right, immediately.
It's a tattoo, Bill.
It's a tattoo. What do you get if you're a member of the wine club?
So first and foremost, you get a bottle of our newly released wine of the month. So we create 12 wines every year that are just for wine club members. They're mm-hmm. not. It won't be just a Cabernet that's on our menu. It's something unique and special. There's all kinds of incentives and points and those kind of things. But really what's special is the community that we've talked about, Dana. As we do trips and travel. So we go to Europe. Our chef Matt is leading a group of 35 people to Australia in about a month from now, so you have to be a wine club member to participate in that.
Yeah.
And then it is really this relationships and experiences. So we do these wine club events at the restaurants. You're spending time at the tasting room. And some of the friendships and relationships that we've seen created over a glass of wine in the restaurants, it's just been incredibly rewarding.
It's true. I've had an opportunity to experience I think Steve Bertrand has experienced one of those as well. And there is this kind of, that transcends the eating, restaurant, dining, and wine experience, where people are like, oh, did you go to the dinner when they had this? Oh my gosh, it was amazing. And then they're talking about, they do. It's just, it's kind of, it's a community.
You have something in common then.
That's
so
right.
You talk about it.
That's right. Yeah. It's
membership
really
card. You get a membership card?
And you do get a membership card, which is important.
Unfortunately, Telly Savalas no longer with us because he was so successful with Players Club.
Players Club was big, right? Yes, it was.
Someone has a question, and it's a good one. Is liking a red blend just being too wishy-washy? Because I'm typically a fan of the red blend wines.
Well, no. So it's one of the most important or best things that we do at Cooper's Hawk is the final blending. So even though a wine might be, what we have here, our Lux Pinot Noir.
Delicious, by the way.
Thank you very much. in order for this to be labeled Pinot Noir, 75% of the wine has to be Pinot Noir. So we have 25% to work with to create a well-balanced wine. But even better when we're creating blends is you do unlimited, right? So if you're not going to call it Cabernet or Pinot Noir and you're going to call it a blend, you can just create a wine that is awesome, you know, in a certain profile. So, and I think people also, you feel like you kind of get more when there's a blend. You feel like there was kind of more thought and love and care right. put into it. So we do a ton of blends because really, between myself and our winemaker, Rob, it just allows us to kind of play and create. And then we blend a lot of grapes together that like professional wine people would say like, oh, you shouldn't do that. And then that makes us want to do it more. So, you know, to kind of break down the rules and just do what's best to create the best wine in the end.
What are your thoughts on places? I'm always impressed by a place that does wine flights because it gives you a sample of various kinds. Are you a fan of that or not a fan of that?
100%. And I think it is one of the success factors of Coopersock. And just by accident, you know, we serve 47 different wines plus the 12 wine of the months. As a consumer, you can taste any of the wines you'd like before you buy them. You know, when you go to a great wine shop, even myself as a, you know, I'm as into wine as you can be. You're still looking at the labels, the price. I think I've heard of that. A friend might have told me. But how great if you can just taste the wine before you buy it. So right. 1,000,000%, I agree.
Some of the grocery stores in town do a thing now where you can get a bottle of wine, a fairly decent bottle of wine, for just a couple of dollars.
$2?
For $2 or $3.
Where do you shop?
The dollar store. I get my wine at the
That's the cheapest wine I've ever heard of.
But you can find...
Is it full size?
No, it's baby size. It's for the kids. But you can get an okay bottle of wine for a couple of dollars. It's not going to knock you down, but it's going to be okay, right?
Yeah, I think it's you know, beauty's in the eye of the beholder, right? Yeah. I mean, so, you know, that might, you know, if you're mixing orange juice with that for breakfast or something, I think that's probably totally okay.
Well, and I think the kind of lesson to be learned there is that, and that's part of experiencing it, is that, it you know, a giant price point on a bottle of wine doesn't automatically mean that it's going to be insane.
Sure.
And there are some really great wines, and we've tried them over the years on the show, you know, that are very price considerate, but like really, really great for what it is that you do with it.
Yeah.
And everybody has their own taste. So
right. Yeah. That's, the fact is you definitely do not have to spend a lot of money to have a great bottle of
although
wine.
Although more than $2, maybe.
Yeah,
per glass, Bill.
Somebody
texted this 630. Can I go there in jeans or do I need to dress up? Bill, did you text that?
Yeah, I texted that in. What do I have to wear when I come to your restaurant?
Is there a dress code?
There is not a dress code. I mean, obviously, we're modern casual, but yeah, in any given moment, you'll see a couple, you know, foursome off the golf course, a group of ladies having lunch, even the red hat groups come in. I mean, professional business, it's a great, comfortable mix of everybody.
And so, for 250,000 people, you've got people from all over the country that are participating and joining the restaurants, part of the wine club. We've talked a little bit about what they get, but so how do they join up? How do they start participating?
Yeah, well, obviously visiting any one of the restaurants, you know, we'll love to talk to you about it. It's a very easy, you know, straightforward.
You don't turn anyone away.
We don't know if you want to join. We'll let you join.
All right, thank you. Thank you.
But it is really, and it's, you know, it's, you try it out, and if it's not for you, you're not signing up for a 5-year commitment. It's a month to month commitment. So,
and really quickly, we don't have a lot of time here, but you have won some pretty prestigious wine awards of late, huh?
Thank you. Yeah, it's been a great year. We've always been proud of our wines, and our winemaker Rob Warren recently has won. So our Lux Pinot won a 99-point score in the San Diego Wine Competition, which is incredible. Our Ice Wine just won top dessert sweet wine of the San Francisco Wine Competition. So we've always competed in all the competitions across the country and even in the world. But when you're playing in California, then you're like super extra proud when you receive some of these top-end awards. And
I saw the awards. They had originally announced that La La Land won, and then you guys were the actual winners. That was quite a surprise at the end.
At least
there.
They got it right.
Yes, yes.
That's awesome.
So one more time, Tim, give the website out where people – and maybe some of the locations. I think there you've got some events, some dinners coming up. I know Tyler Florence is going to be in town.
Yeah, yeah, we can't wait. We're going to do an awesome dinner with Tyler. We've created a wonderful wine with him, a collaborative wine, a Pinot Noir Rosé, which we're incredibly proud of, and I know Tyler is too. But, yeah, we're in 8 states. We've got Florida covered. We're all throughout the Midwest, definitely heavy in Chicago, and then kind of the Virginia, D.C. markets. And
is it Coopersock.com?
CH, it can be, or the easy one is CH. Winery.com.
Excellent. Tim, great meeting you.
Great meeting you. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely.
And then tune in on Saturdays, 2 till 4, On the Road with Dane.
Thank you,
Dane. Get on the road.
You've talked me into it.
Will there be wine for the listeners?
Yes.
Yes. Always. Always. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Tim.
Thank you.
A little break, then some news. Stay where you are. Bill and Wendy, WGN. Wendy, if you'll remember back in December, Paula Fraley and Anthony Kaufman joined us to talk about the Doc 10 Film Festival, and they're here again, or have you guys just not left? Maybe I didn't look over and notice.
I'm sleeping.
You guys have been here since December?
Time flies, Bill.
That's a long time. How are you guys?
Good.
Nice to see you. I was just telling you, Wendy and I had on one of the stars of the documentary Life Animated a couple of weeks ago. And like any documentary, here's what I kept thinking, because I love documentaries. I just think they're such an important part of filmmaking. But every once in a while, one will get a little extra attention. And I think that's good for the whole business because it wakes people up to realize you really need to be seeing these films.
Yeah, it's a great time for documentaries. We're seeing them, you know, pop out in theaters. One of the films we're opening with, Step, is going to be a big movie this summer. It's a documentary, but it's going to be like a big movie.
I keep hearing such great things about Step. Let's go through what you're getting with Step. What is that?
Well, we're kicking it off, actually, with a performance by the South Shore Drill Team. One of the things that we really like to do with Doc 10 is to partner experiences with the film, so it's an extension of watching the movie. And in this case, we're going to kick off the whole festival with this fantastic performance. I don't know if you've ever seen them at the Bud Billiken Parade.
Yes, they are amazing. Incredible. You get so excited while watching and listening. It's amazing to watch these drill teams.
Yeah, they're wonderful. So they're kicking us off at the Davis Thursday night at 8 o'clock, followed by the screening of Step, and Anthony will be Q&A with Amanda Lippitz, the director, on Skype, which will be great.
But I think the thing about Step is it's one of these, you know, inspirational movies. People are calling it the next Hoop Dreams.
Yeah,
and I think, you know, that's the kind of movie that does like break out and lift up, you know, the industry, lift up our appreciation for docs as great stories.
Yeah.
Not like just things, educational kind of sounding things, you know.
When you're a filmmaker, and my daughter's going through this now, she's at the New School where I know you teach, and she's studying to be a documentary filmmaker. So what is it about the mind of a filmmaker that decides those are the types of stories I want to follow as the true stories and give them my spin? What goes on in the mindset there?
Well, I really think that it's and empathy for other human beings. It's that, you know, the students, I mean, I think all filmmakers really have a desire to tell great stories. And documentary filmmakers in particular really get this sort of deeper, they get their fix from, you know, real stories about real people. And when they do it well, as Anthony and I have talked about these films, you walk out of the theater going, that was a great movie. Mm-hmm. Not, that was a great documentary, and it was important for me to see it. You know,
Your daughter must be a good person.
Nope.
Really?
Because she's terrible.
Because most documentary filmmakers, honestly, they're like good people. I covered, as a journalist, the fiction films, Hollywood films.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry, but documentary filmmakers, they're just so much nicer than
isn't that crazy? Yeah.
Is that because it comes from a subject that's typically close to their heart that they want to tell the world about? Is that usually the case?
I think so, but I also think there's something about the kind of connection you make as a filmmaker with another person who is sharing their story with you. I mean, it's
very intimate.
It's very intimate. And so I think it just sort of keeps you very much attuned and sensitive to human beings, human nature, great stories.
I have to applaud Netflix because even though if you have a Netflix account, you can complain about the number of films that they show on Netflix. I'm always surprised at the low number. They go out of their way to have so many selections in the documentary category. I'm not sure whose decision that is, but I really am thrilled with the number of documentaries they show on Netflix.
Yeah, every time I tell people I'm a documentary programmer, they say, oh, I just saw this great documentary on Netflix.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know what? In Hollywood, though, every story has been told. They're remaking all these movies. It's like they've run out of ideas. So documentaries are fresh.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, how many, you know, fourth and fifth editions of the same story can you go to?
Right.
You know, I do. I think you see these fresh, inspirational, you walk out of them going, God, I had no idea. I had no idea. And now not only do you have an idea, but you have this empathetic connection to another human being. And you walk out of documentaries a changed person in some way.
That's so
we
true.
Need more of that empathy these days, don't we?
Yeah, no question about it. Helped settle a bet between a friend of mine who's a big film buff and myself. He maintains that documentaries are the only true source of film that is 100% accurate and true, and there's no bias. But I say that even in a documentary, the director is still showing some sort of bias. What do you think?
I believe that is the case. Yes.
Am I right?
Yes.
You said there is bias.
I said there is bias.
You win that bet.
I think so.
Oh, yeah. No, I think ever since the first documentary, they've always been biased. Everyone says, you know, comes up with the example of Nanook of the North, which is like this, you know, nature documentary. And it's totally biased. Yeah. It's crazy. And it's like it's got staged scenes. You see the Inuit guy. You know, he's in a fight with some animal, but it's all set up.
Right.
What was the first documentary we would all be aware of, like the first breakout one? Can you think of it?
Well, in Chicago, it's definitely Hoop Dreams.
Hoop Dreams.
Yeah. I think in the broader sense, I'm trying to think. What do you think, Anthony?
Roger and Me.
Oh, yeah.
Roger and Me was huge, yeah.
And that's not that long ago, but documentaries must have come before that, right?
The very first movies were documentaries.
They were, weren't
they? The very first time they turn on cameras, they directed it at real life.
Yeah.
They're at the beginning of cinema.
How have they changed? Have they changed dramatically since then? They probably have in some respect.
Definitely. I mean, I think one of the reasons why documentaries are, you know, they're just such a wide audience for them now is that along with distribution like Netflix and Hulu and Amazon, and it seems like every month there's a new distributor getting into the documentary business.
Yeah.
I think that documentary filmmakers have figured out that, and in a sense, I think we've accepted that there is bias in documentaries. And therefore, if there is, you can use narrative storytelling techniques in telling the story of a real person or, you know, real life that makes it that much more engaging. And so I think the storytelling has actually gotten better.
And the stigma seems to be all but gone, where people used to go, there's a movie I heard about that sounds good, but it's a documentary. I don't think I want to sit through that. That's pretty much evaporated, hasn't it?
I think so, although I think documentaries, they still have a little bit more of a hurdle in terms of getting people to the theater, at least. Maybe on TV, maybe on Netflix, it's fairly equal, but I feel like getting people to realize that documentaries can also be like a big screen experience, maybe that's a little more of an effort we need to train them about. I have to say, there's a movie called Casting JonBenet that we're screening.
Yeah.
Which maybe you've heard about.
I've heard of it.
Yeah. And we all know that story. And talk about like taking a topic and doing something completely different with it and doing something that, you know, Hollywood has already, you know, told maybe these stories. Mm-hmm. This is a film that treats the subject matter in a way that you would never expect.
But isn't that becoming part of the game of a documentary is that filmmakers have figured out you could tell a story from A to B to C, but you want some sort of an unexpected twist to happen at some point, right?
Absolutely. And also, I think that there's a desire to tell cinematic stories, like Anthony was saying. I mean, we have Islands in the Whales about the Faroe Islands. It is stunningly beautiful. And it's something that on a small screen, I mean, it's a great story, but on a big screen in a movie theater in the dark with a lot of people, it is stunning cinematography. Trophy is another one that that documents a lot of things in Africa. And so you see these incredible vistas, wild animals and parts of the world that you may not have seen in any other way. And so to see it huge on a screen in a theater, it makes the storytelling that much more captivating.
And Bill, you mentioned twists and turns. That's what life entails too. You know, every time you think something's going really great, you get a wrench thrown into the plan. Dave has a phone call, if we could just jump in. Dave has called 312-981-7200. Paula Fraley, CEO and co-founder of the Chicago Media Project, the group behind this Doc 10 Film Festival, and the Anthony Kaufman, programmer for the festival. What's going on, Dave?
Hey, kids, how you doing? I'm so glad to hear you talking about documentaries. I think your guest would acknowledge that sometimes documentaries can enact very significant social change, and I'm thinking particularly of Blackfish.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's right.
And then a documentary that I caught on Amazon Prime is Finders Keepers. Are you familiar with that?
Yes. I love that movie.
A guy is in a plane crash and as a result loses his leg. The leg turns up in a smoker purchased at a yard sale, and it's all about the legal battle between these two guys over who's the rightful owner of this leg.
Now, that's a story we've heard a thousand times. What made this different? How did they separate this leg?
That's a fantastic
documentary. And
I really appreciate you guys bringing up the subject.
Thank you, Dave.
You should think about going to opening night. Screening of Step is taking place. It's all happening Thursday night, tomorrow night, 8 p.m. at the Davis Theater, although I don't have the address for the Davis Theater.
It's 4614 North Lincoln.
There you go.
Dave, easy to find.
Dave brings up two great examples of documentaries, mm-hmm. and I think we have both of those kinds of films at the festival. We have, you know, something that is a social issue, you know, mm-hmm. Like Blackfish, you know, you have a film that actually forced change at SeaWorld. We have some films that are about, you know, Black Lives Matter and issues that are, you know, really important and still timely. But we also have, you know, a film about obit writers, you know, which is a little bit quirkier.
God, I love reading obituaries.
Oh, I know, don't you?
I love it.
So the screening of Obit, which is Sunday at 4 o'clock, afterwards at the Q&A, we not only have Vanessa Gould, the director, but we have Bruce Weber, who for 8 years was head of the Obit department at the New York Times. So they're going to be in the Q&A. And that is then followed by a live reading of postings on legacy.com, which is the website that hosts a lot of the guest books that people write in after someone has passed away. So we've curated an excerpt of some of the quirkiest, funniest, most meaningful entries from legacy.com. We're going to do a live reading in the theater.
That's Sunday at 4?
Yes.
That sounds great.
It's so funny because to the casual observer, you hear a story like that and you go, is that going to make a movie like somebody who writes obits? But I have seen so many documentaries. There was one about 5 or 6 years ago about people that were addicted to crossword puzzles.
Oh,
all they wanted to do was crossword
movie.
Puzzles. That was fantastic. Mm-hmm. So every once in a while, something will surprise you, even though you think this couldn't last a whole movie. It does, you know?
Yeah.
I think it goes to the people.
Yeah.
Right? It's just, you know, we connect with these people.
Yep.
We connect with, you know, the obsessive crossword puzzlers, or we connect with not just the obit writers, the journalists, the storytellers, but the people that they're writing about.
Yep.
And that's part of what makes obit great, actually. It's like, it's about tributes to people's lives.
Sure.
I am hooked on Candy Crush, and I'm going to make a documentary, and I bet everybody would love it, because they're hooked on Candy Crush, they will understand it.
You can't go wrong.
It's
the Doc 10 Film Festival starting tomorrow night, running through April 2nd. We'll pick this up in just a little bit if you want to jump in, 312-981-7200. It's Bill and it's Wendy on WGN. If you're a fan of documentaries, or even not a fan, just somebody who's curious, here's what you need to do. Check out the Doc 10 Film Festival. It's running tomorrow night through April the 2nd. Yeah, a very exciting time if you're a fan of this sort of film. It takes place at the Davis Theater. It's 4614 North Lincoln Avenue. You want to see it. You want to be a part of this. We started talking about some of the films that are there. What's the one you're most excited about?
Oh,
is that hard to pick just
there's
one?
There's 10, right?
Do you have a favorite daughter?
Oh, yes, yeah. I do.
Oh.
Right. All of them.
Yes, I do.
I am excited for all of them. One thing that's kind of cool is we actually have the North American premiere of a doc from Israel that won basically all the major awards in Israel.
What is this?
And it's called Death in the Terminal. Sounds upbeat, maybe,
yeah.
It's a very powerful story about an attack that took place in a bus terminal, and it's special to me because we are, you know, showing it. No one else has shown it in the U.S. before, it's also a very timely story about prejudice and jumping to conclusions, and you know, how people react in an intense situation. So.
And it's a fascinating look at how, I think there are like, what, 4 or 6 people that they interview who were there when the attack took place,
mm-hmm.
and how they came to conclusions about who did it and the consequences of that. And they're juxtaposed. I mean, it's a kind of fascinating study of mob violence and of chaos and how that affects your interpretation of events.
But it unfolds in real time. And it's really tense and powerful.
Riveting.
And
it's
actually,
riveting.
The guy who produced and wrote The Hurt Locker, the Hollywood movie, he signed on as an executive producer of the documentary to help get the word out about it.
So many times when filmmakers are making a documentary, they think they know what the story is and where they're heading, and then while filming it, it becomes something different, right?
Yeah,
absolutely.
No, I think, and there's a couple of films at the festival, I feel like. I mean, the director of Step, she didn't know what was going to happen to these young girls who were, basically, the story follows them in numerous kind of ways, but but the intention was about first generation going to college mm-hmm. from their family. And, you know, what happens if none of them get into college? You know, that's right. a very different kind of film than if they all right. got into college sure. or, you know, so, yeah.
And Chicago South Shore Drill Team will be performing before the screening of Step, which is taking place tomorrow night, 8 p.m., Davis Theater, 4614 North Lincoln. A texter says this conversation fails without the mention of This Is Spinal Tap, but that's a mockumentary. That's not really yes. a documentary.
But whatever it can
still
do
qualifies.
To help draw people's attention to documentaries, so, I say more of it.
I will tell this person they have to see a documentary called Anvil. The Anvil story, or something
I know
like
that. I've yeah. seen bits and pieces of that. It's yeah, really yeah. entertaining.
It is the true life. This Is Spinal Tap.
Yeah. Oh, I have to see that too.
Yeah, and you know who else is doing fake documentaries really well is Bill Hader. Does there's a show you've seen it as well?
Love it. Documentary Now.
Yeah,
that's great.
Fantastic spoofs on many
and
of
real
the
documentaries.
Famous documentaries. Oh, hilarious.
Yeah, so yeah. good.
It really is.
All right. Once again, if you want to be a part of this, it's the Doc 10 Film Festival. It starts tomorrow night. It runs through April the 2nd. It takes place at the Davis Theater, 4614 North Lincoln Avenue. And the website they want to check out is?
Doc10.org.
Just that simple. Great to see both of you again.
Come
Thank
back
you
before
for being
next
here.
Year, will you?
Yeah.
Oh,
please. Whenever you want. It's Paula Fraley. It's Anthony Kaufman. And again, it's the Doc 10 Film Festival starting tomorrow night. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Greatly appreciated. A quick break, some news coming up. Stick around, Bill and Wendy, WGN.